everyone, and welcome to episode 8 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whiles any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day. This, one of Shakespeare's most famous monologues, is spoken by a weary, outnumbered Henry V before one of the most famous clashes in history, the Battle of Agincourt. Most people, whether they're history buffs or not, have heard of this epic underdog story, and they have an inkling that it took place somewhere in France. But where exactly? Tradition has it that the battle was fought somewhere between Agincourt and Tramacourt. But was it? Here to talk about his new research into the true location of the Battle of Agincourt is Dr. Michael Livingston, professor of English at the Citadel and co-editor of the award-winning Battle of Crécy, a casebook. Michael's work is the featured article in the very latest issue of Medieval Warfare magazine, and here he is to give us the scoop on the missing battlefield of Agincourt. Thanks, Michael, for joining us to talk about Agincourt today.
No problem. Glad to be here.
So we need to start at the beginning. So tell us a little bit about the Battle of Agincourt and why it was important.
All right. So the Battle of Agincourt, you know, this is one of the big ones. I mean, you know, Hastings is up there. Agincourt is up there. The people are familiar with Henry V, the Band of Brothers speech. You know, this is one of the great battles in history. And I'd say kind of the reason historically why it's important. I mean, obviously it has cultural importance. Historically, it's important because of this, the way that the battle is undertaken from such an underdog position from the English point of view. They have far too few men-at-arms, way too many archers in terms of what normal tactics would be. This forces Henry to make some very odd decisions on the field. They are outnumbered. They have been on the run. They're tired. They're exhausted. And they're more or less trapped. They're cornered in. They were trying to get away. The English don't like me phrasing it that way, but they were trying. They were on the run. And they got caught. So the fact that despite all those difficult factors, Henry V was able to have such a resounding victory, and it really is a resounding victory, is historically impressive, historically important in geopolitical terms, and important for us as those who study, who look at warfare and tactics and strategy and war behaviors. It's really important as a moment in history for that regard too.
Yeah, I mean, this is one that, as you say, people remember and they talk about and they reference all the time. So you've just written an article for Medieval Warfare magazine that questions the traditional view of where this battle was actually fought. So tell us a little bit about where you think this battle is fought and why you think it's not in the spot where people thought it was before.
Okay, yeah. So let me preface this by saying I don't try to screw up where battles were. I've gotten this with Brunenburg, with Brynglos, with Crécy. I'm starting to get this kind of reputation, and it's nothing I aim to do. You know, my interest is in source work and geographical work, topography, and trying to, you know, join these things together as best one can. And it just so happens that we kind of keep finding problems with how we've interpreted fields and historical moments on the ground. And it's gotten me, yeah, into some trouble, I suppose. So I mean, when I actually went to Agincourt and visited the field, I had no intention of changing where this battlefield was. I mean, you know, everybody, the people I was with, which were fellow medievalists, I will let them go unnamed for their own safety. You know, we were like, this is where it is. Everybody knows where it is. There's no questions about this. You know, what can we analyze about the field as it stands and, you know, use that information. And I was totally willing. That was great. It was fantastic. And it was cool to be on the field and be like, oh yeah, and this must be how this happened. And that was really neat. But at the same time, so much didn't make sense about it. What we're told in the sources is that the English take one position, and then when the French will not attack them, they advance to another position to provoke the French attack. Well, on the traditional site that everybody has it happening, you actually, the the English advance puts them into a better position than they would have been in the first place. Why on earth, first of all, were they not in that position in the first place? And why on earth would them getting into a better position provoke the French to fight? That makes no sense. And so, let me just see what the sources say. Let me just kind of play around with it a little bit. There's got to be something I'm missing. And kind of the more I looked at it, the worse it got. One of the big things that stuck out very quickly was the field was too small. If we take the numbers of English that we've got and what the sources say about the arrangement and that sort of information, you know, a human being takes up a certain amount of space. And that's kind of, I think, in my own foolish way, a fairly standard measurement. You know, people take up space. And you can't stack people on top of people. You know, they take up space. If you line up people on that field, I mean, and you could do this at home with Google Earth, you know, just measure it out and say, okay, this is how wide a line we need for this many guys in this kind of, you know, formation. And you use like the most conservative numbers you can, the least number of men that are said to be on the field, the tightest packed you can get them, you know, the kind of leanest line you can make that will still tactically work. You end up getting a line that is about 50% wider than you have room for. And those numbers actually, Ann Curry has done amazing work putting together lists of, you know, the men involved in this. And she's got some really great rationale for the number of men involved. And, you know, I'm talking about a number of men that's 3,700 men fewer than Ann Curry says took part. And you still are 50% too long for the space.
Yeah, in the article you say the numbers that you're working with are painfully conservative, and they do look painfully conservative.
They're painfully conservative. It doesn't fit. It doesn't work. And so, you know, like, well, what are the other options? I mean, well, either every source we've got is lying, all of Anne's numbers are wrong, you know, a whole bunch of land apparently like disappeared through some black hole in the meantime. Or it's in the wrong spot. I mean, you know, there's just not a lot of wiggle room here. You only have so many options. And I'm very much of a mind, and I, you know, with Crazy and other things, this is what I've done is I say, you know, look, the sources, they're there. Let's trust them to the best we can. Let's assume, I mean, everybody's got their own perspective, right? But let's assume that they're doing the best they can to record what they've seen. And so all I did was essentially, all right, what are our best witnesses? What do they say happened? Let me map it. And let me use these numbers that are involved and let me map it. And yeah, the end result is the battle is, it's close. It's close to being the same spot. You're in the same ballpark, but it's definitely configured in a very different way. And it is not in that sort of famous narrow field between the small villages of Azincourt and Tramacourt today. It's not. It's south of there. It's basically centered on Maison Salle. So in kind of a nutshell, that's what I've done. And that's what I anticipate getting attacked on soon.
So this came out of actually visiting the field. That's kind of what stirred your curiosity, because you've mentioned in the article that Tim Sutherland, who's an archaeologist, also looked at that field, the traditional field, and found no evidence of a battle being there. So was it visiting the field, or was it this article that kind of stirred this for you?
So it was visiting the field. I more or less refuse to write about anything that I haven't visited. I think it's really irresponsible, tremendously irresponsible, to try and write about things happening on a ground you have not visited and seen. Ground can change over time, but over the periods of time we're working with and the areas we're working with, it's minimal. So topography is still tremendously useful. And it was that visit. And it was actually after I started hemming and hawing about this might be not in the right spot that I came across Tim's article, in which he argued, well, didn't argue, but presented the possibility that the battle actually took place north of the traditional site, which pushes it up towards Rousseauville. And I thought, well, you know, good for him for admitting the fact that all the digs that have been done, they've found nothing. Have in fact found pre-medieval artifacts. Any sort of excuse that the ground has eaten up the, you know, the artifacts through acidity or what have you goes away at that point. So, I mean, he says something like, there's no evidence for the battle having happened at all, or something like this. Wonderfully provocative. Obviously, Tim thinks the battle happened, everybody. But it's sort of pointing out, we just don't have evidence, you know, and we should. There should be a lot of evidence of this battle. It's a lot of people died in a pretty small space. There should be evidence. So, yeah, he kind of pushed it to the north. And that, because I was looking at the sources, that didn't work for me at all. It's got to be to the south. Now, it turned out as I was finalizing all this, Tim has put out a second article talking about the archaeology or lack thereof. And he actually does mention this southern site in a different way than I present it. But he does say, you know, hey, this, it could also be to the south. But yeah, no digs have been done in this area. No surveys. It's untouched. And I think probably should be touched.
Given the chronicles that suggest that there are mass graves, there should be something to find there. And especially you've seen on a map that there, it suggests that there are mass graves there. So can you tell us a little bit about the map that you looked at that kind of has some locations marked out that might have given you some clues as well?
Yeah, so I did this with Crazy as well. You know, try and go back to the earliest maps one can of the area. Now, obviously, you know, surveying in a kind of modern concept is a modern concept. And the first we can really get to that level of detail is around the time of Napoleon. That is nevertheless of tremendous value. This is before the interstates have gone through, before anything like that. It is a relatively pristine shot of the countryside. And those maps, which are called the cadastral maps, one of the wonderful things they have, in addition to a lot of just kind of rote detail about where roads are and things like that, is they also have a lot of place names on them, local place names that they preserve. Some of which are still in use today, some of which are not. In the area that the sources triangulated me to, we do get a lot of very interesting place names there. A Death Valley, which is in the spot where the valley where everybody died should be. A pit, a ditch of some kind of rotting that is about where everybody would have, like where you would expect a mass burial. There is this feature called that. Now, there could be other explanations, but certainly being in the right place, having the sort of name one would expect of a mass burial, being the more or less the right dimension compared to the size of the pit that we're told is dug. I mean, it's, you know, it's worth looking at is what I'll always say. You know, I wouldn't say, you know, I'm 100% sure this is anything, but it's worth investigation because it fits all the features we would expect. Another location where we would expect there to be burials, major number of them as the battle was dissipating and people were being run down from behind. That's an area that's called the Little Crosses. You know, so one would expect to find something there as well. The other thing about these early maps is they show the battle. We have the battle being shown well before the cadastral maps into the 1700s. In fact, just in the 1704, I think, is the earliest map I have found that has the battle marked. And it's not marked in the traditional location. It's marked where I'm saying it is. And that's interesting to me, you know. So with any of this stuff, you know, until we find evidence, we don't know where it is. We don't. All we can do is try and, again, triangulate from the information we have. What makes sense of topography? What makes sense of tactics? What makes sense of the numbers involved? And what fits our sources to the highest degree we can? And yeah, in this case, all of that says to me, it's over here. It's not where everybody thought it was. It's got to be over here.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the sources because medieval sources are problematic when it comes to battles. They have numbers inflated for sure. But there are a lot of commonalities in the sources about this particular battle that would point to a place with a valley, a place with a watershed, and a few other things like that. So that was kind of mostly your guide for this when you were looking into it, right? The chronicle accounts?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, anything I can use. In this case, it was mostly chronicles. You know, with Crazy, it was also looking at poetry and things like that. It's anything that will give us topographical information. And that's not to say that you're saying, oh, well, this person said so, it has to be. But you're trying to get sort of the broad perspective here. And, you know, boy, a lot of people are talking about there being some kind of, like, depression in between these groups. We're getting an awful lot of that. Seems like something we should look for. And then you look at the traditional battle site, and it's flat as an ironing board. You know, you're like, well, that's a little weird. So we need a spot that ideally would have that kind of thing. Yeah, our numbers are all over the place. I mean, that's just, the numbers are a disaster, which is why it is so valuable what Ann Curry has done, because she's found a way with these muster rolls and things to give us a sense of numbers that is more objective than, you know, some monk saying there were 100,000 men there or something insane. And he's like, oh, no, okay. Let's look at these more concrete numbers, which as I said, the traditional field, you're still 3,700 men short. even to get it 50% too wide. It just makes it so bad. But yeah, this idea that we use the sources and trust the sources as much as we can. I get pushback from this, but to me, most of the pushback is based on the fact that what I am finding doesn't fit with their preconception because they've kicked a source out, right? Because they've said, oh, we know where the battle happened, so we must ignore this source, and this source. They've got to be exaggerating because we know where the battle happened. Well, if you take out the base assumption that we know where the battle happened, then all this stuff comes into play. And very often it's like, well wait. It didn't happen there. And in fact, again, Crecy, Agincourt, the same issue, archaeological digs have found nothing. I mean, nothing. And you're like, well, we have no evidence it happened there. So to use that as an assumption is kind of a difficult thing to say. In Agincourt here, you know, I mean, the early maps put in a different spot. You know, I mean, it just, yeah, it's odd to me, the need or the desire to ignore what witnesses say. I mean, I had somebody yelling at me about Crecy that said, well, you can't trust this particular source. And I was like, that's the King of England. And he's riding on the battlefield. Like, why is that? What? Really? You think, you know, this other person who's writing 80 years later in England is a better source than the king who's on the battlefield? Like, I mean, I just work here, but I feel like one of those is more reliable than the other on principle. Again, not exclusively. You have to still, you know, well, is the king lying or misunderstanding or whatever, right? But yes, I try very hard to get at the sources. And, you know, this is why I'm always trying to get back to the manuscript, you know, trying to get to that back to that original, because how do I know if the translators have not, in their preconception, translated something a certain way to fit what they assumed was true, which that isn't always the case. We have to go back. What is the most raw material we can get? Now let's build from that what we can without any assumptions. And if it ends up that Agincourt is exactly where everybody thought it was, well, awesome. Well, cool. We've shown that. If it ends up not, okay. I mean, you know, I have no skin in the fight. I wasn't there. It doesn't matter to me. I just want what's right, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's hard, even for historians, for us to get past this bias that the people of the past, they may have been mistaken about things. So I think it's important to trust the sources, like you say. And I think, if I'm remembering this right, when you were creating the Crecy casebook, which is amazing, by the way, you found some translation errors that kind of were steering the translations, didn't you? I thought you found
some. Yeah, I did. No, good memory. Yeah. So this is a good case in point. There is a fairly well-known source for the Battle of Crecy. It's a late source, but it does give a place name. It says the battle happened and it gives a place name. The place name it gives is West Glees. Now, the traditional site has no West Glees. What is this? Nobody could know what it was. Well, north of the traditional site, north and west of the traditional site, some ways, there was a place named called Wat Glees. So the translator and the editors, in fact, of that particular source just changed it. They're like, well, yeah, I mean, this guy wrote West Glees, but obviously he didn't mean to write that. Obviously he meant to write Wat Glees because that would fit with what we know is true, where the battle was. Well, he didn't. He wrote West Glees, which means west of the church. Like, all right, let's find a location west of the church. And instead of just changing what he wrote. And so, yeah, when I, you know, at that point when I was, you know, triangling the sources, it was pretty awesome, you know, that when we triangled, what, you know, what does everybody say? Where is it? Where is it not? You know, all that kind of stuff. And everything was narrowing down to one spot to see, wow, it's just west of the church. Like, well, all right, he was right. Or, you know, presumably, right? Again, so we put shovels in the ground. You know, I don't know. With Crecy, what I say is I'm 100% sure where the battle was not. I'm only 90 something sure where it is. I have a lot of unanswered questions about that site. But yeah, I know where it wasn't. I mean, it couldn't have been for a list that's too long to go into right now. But yeah, it does happen, and it's not to say that the previous editors and translators, you know, had some kind of ill intent. They were trying trying to do what they thought was the right thing. They just were working on an assumption that, you know, I think is not necessarily a tenable one, that, as you said, everybody has said this, and they couldn't possibly be wrong. And it's this weight of tradition and kind of a bowing down to the authority of the past, which to some degree may be baked in to academia, in the sense that we all, as we're getting going through the ranks, getting a PhD, then trying to get a professorship, whatever, you're constantly sort of, well, the people before me are smarter than I am. You know, they're the ones who said I could pass this class. They're the ones who said whether my dissertation was okay. They're the ones who say whether I can be published. They're the ones. And so there's, I've always wondered if there's kind of a, almost like an imposter complex that everybody's kind of grappling with. And it prevents us from just saying, yeah, but why? Like, we all say it happened here, but why? Like, what if it didn't? Like, how about if I just check your work, right? And to some degree, we always have to take something as a given. You can't just do this ad infinitum, you know, like, why does that word mean what it means? I mean, like, that'll go on forever. But at a certain point, it is still worthwhile to say, well, what's the basis of that? And to discover sometimes, yeah, it's not quite right. So yeah, I don't know why I'm so willing to do that. I honestly don't. I just don't understand why everybody's not doing that. But I mean, I'm glad though. It's fun for me.
Well, speaking of imposters, you and I have both come to history through literature. So we in some ways have a different perspective, I think, which can be valuable. So I wanted to ask you what you think coming at history and chronicles from kind of a lit perspective might have contributed to your work in questioning these things.
And that's a good point. I mean, it could. You know, in literature, you're taught kind of at a base level to look underneath the text, right? The text, yeah, the text tells us this, but what's going on underneath that? What can we figure out about context and bias and intention and meaning and symbolism, all this kind of stuff? And I mean, for me personally, you know, my initial degrees were historical. And in the course of that, so I had this kind of historical mindset, and I've always wanted to do history. And then I was like, well, manuscripts are cool, because they are. And everybody who listens to your podcast knows this. Manuscripts are awesome.
Yeah.
I would put that more forcefully, but I don't know if I'm allowed to say naughty words. So they're very cool. They're very cool. I'll say that. They're very cool. And realizing kind of early on, I had opportunities to take paleography. I took a number of classes with Tim Graham when I was at the Medieval Institute, and he was. And kind of realizing there was like this skill set that not necessarily everybody was getting. And I thought, well, that's going to be useful for the job market. You know, everybody wants a manuscript person. And like, your listeners are surely laughing right now. But I was young. I was like, I'm going to be a paleographer, and like, my job is set.
That's right. In it for the money.
You're just going to let it rain. And kind of getting into the text and recognizing the problems of editing and what a huge task that is. And how it determines whole fields of study and whole thought based on an edition that may or may not be correct. And so, well, okay, I'm gonna do this stuff. And as a result, I did. I went into my second master's and PhD are both in literature. And yeah, I have a historical bent, admittedly. I mean, I was constantly trying to push things back to the historical lens. And if I'll now upset some other people by saying that whenever things got too theoretical, I'd get twitchy. I'd be like, well, you know, like, but
yeah, me too.
But yeah, that's how is that supposed to make any sense? You know, like that's you're crossing historical timelines. We can't do that. Time space continuum, people. I saw Back to the Future. And so, yeah, so I got into literary stuff that way. And it does, to get back to your question, in literature, you have to keep kind of multiple doors open as you're reading. It's not a process of shutting doors. It's a process of opening them. A lot of history, historical research, is kind of the opposite, where you're trying to figure out what happened. And to some degree, that's shutting those doors, right? You know, that, well, could it have gone through this door? Nope, shut that door and shut this is the way it went. So yeah, I've kind of got those two mindsets. One is trying to shut the doors and figure out what really happened, where this battle was, what took place there. But at the same time, as I'm processing it all, I'm like trying to throw every door open I can, because I don't know which door is the right one yet. So, you know, I'm just kicking doors. That door is shut. Why is it shut? Open the door and let's see if it's okay to shut it. And it is kind of odd and, you know, multiple personality a bit, but I guess so far it seems to be working. I don't know. It's just a strange way of processing information, but it's what I do.
So. Well, I totally get it. And you've put together, like we said before, you put together a case book, which has a whole bunch of literature in it, as well as chronicle histories. And now you're working on a reader of medieval warfare for University of Toronto, which should be coming out later this year. So what kind of stuff is in that?
Yeah, so the medieval warfare reader, which is coming out from University of Toronto Press, is that I believe it's toward the end of the year, so October probably. So I'm co-editing this with Kelly DeVries, who's a good friend and colleague, and a traditional medieval historian. And what's been fun about it, Toronto approached us and said, well, you know, we want to do one of these readers on medieval warfare. And the first things we said, because, you know, Kelly had worked with me on Crazy. That's his book, too. He shares the blame, everybody. And, you know, we said, look, with Crazy, we opened up the canon, if you will, of what should be considered. You know, my two favorite sources in that book were both ones that nobody had looked at. One was a journal of the king's kitchen written on the battlefield saying where he was and what he ate, which is kind of useful for locating the battle. And the other was what appears to be a poem written on the battlefield within a couple of days by a French herald who is deeply traumatized, trying to figure out who died. And it's one of the most amazing things I've ever written or read in my life.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's amazing.
It's extraordinary. And these things were ignored because they weren't quote-unquote history. Well, that makes no sense to me. There's no evidence is evidence. I don't care what it's from. Is it a sermon? Is it a poem? Is it a chronicle? It's evidence. It's all subject to the same questions, and it's all potential grist for the mill. We need it all. So we said to Toronto, look, this is not going to be, if you want just like little battle accounts, like we're the wrong people. This is going to be very wide open. And they said, no, absolutely. That's great. That's fantastic. And then as Kelly and I went back and sat down to do it, we said, okay, well, we're going to actually open it up beyond that. So we do have, if you're wanting battle stuff, there's lots of battle stuff, everybody. There's going to be lots of battle stuff. But there's also responses to warfare, whether they're poetic, whether they're, you know, laments, whether they are glories. We have accounts of just warfare trauma in there on the part of the individual suffering trauma. On the part of the populace, suffering the trauma of warfare going on in their backyard. We have accounts in there about returning veterans. Like, you know, these people go to war, they come back home. What's that like? What is happening to them? How are they being treated? These are questions that, you know, for all that I do medieval warfare, we rarely talk about this stuff. We really rarely talk about it. We're always just focused on the blocks of color moving around on the map and not on what's this like on the ground, and what's it like for everybody around it, and what's it like for these guys 20 years later? And we're trying very hard to open that up as much as possible. There's a lot of stuff in there, a lot of really great stuff in there that's bringing women's perspectives to the forefront that are, you know, what is this like for the women left at home? What is this like for the women who are taking part? What is this like for, I mean, we're just trying to open it up as much as possible. So I'm tremendously excited about the book. I'm tremendously excited. It's huge. It was one of these things where we're like, well, what's the word count? And they gave us the word count, and we're like maybe one under. I mean, it's like, okay, we're gonna pack in everything we can. It wasn't like, oh yeah, that's pie in the sky. We're like, well, we'll see if we can get under that. it's really great. So lots of classic stuff, but tons of stuff people don't know. We opened it up geographically, tremendously wide. So it's not just on the kind of English-French axis that so many of us are kind of used to operating. It's much, much wider. I had a ball. I did a map of just where the sources are that we're using. I just mapped them on a map with dates to just kind of visualize for the reader the breadth of this. And it was great fun. And when I first did it, we actually identified like holes in the map. Like, wait, we don't have anything from this little, we have a gap in the map. All right, let's find something to fill that gap. So, I think it's going to be a really useful volume for people, for professors who are, you know, teaching classes in medieval warfare, and for students wanting to get a perspective on warfare. And it's also going to be great fun for people just you know, the amateur, the person at home, whatever, who's interested in just medieval stuff. We got such a range. A bunch of it's new translations that we've done because old translations were problematic for one reason or another. So it's going to be good fun. I'm excited for it.
Yeah, I'm excited. I can't wait. I can't wait for it to come out. And speaking of stuff that you're writing, I wanted to mention, people might not know that you're actually a novelist as well, although your novels take place in the ancient world pretty much exclusively, right?
Yeah. Well, the ones out so far, yeah. The Shards of Heaven trilogy is it's based the years, the rise of Augustus Caesar, essentially. And they have a little bit of a fantasy element to them. But yeah, they're historical fantasy or secret history that publishers call it different things. But yeah, that's just something I kind of do on my spare time.
You have so much spare time.
unless y'all can make it a bestseller, I don't make enough money from those books to quit my day job. So
Fair enough. And the next thing going on in your day job is working on the Battle of Hastings, right? Yes. Just doing some research.
Yeah, I'm doing some research on the Battle of Hastings. Again, for the record, I'm not trying to change where the Battle of Hastings is, though a lot of people have found out that I'm working on Hastings. And again, I'm working on the Battle of Hastings with Kelly DeVries. We were approached, you know, will you guys write a book on Hastings? And we said, sure. So now when people have found that out, now I'm getting all this email. I'm getting preemptive strikes of people attacking me for stuff I haven't said yet. Like, they're like, how dare you move the Battle of Hastings? I haven't even published on this. Like, like, back off, y'all. But then I'm also getting these pleas, which I think is interesting. Pleas from people who have, you know, for a long time felt that Hastings was in the wrong spot. And because of my background, I guess, sort of view this as like, this is the shot that I'm going to be the one to prove them right. Yeah, I mean, both those are fine. I'm not mad at anybody. It's totally cool. But, you know, I just have to keep saying, you know, I'm not setting out to overturn any wagons here, you know, push off any shield walls. I'm just, what do we got? What are the facts? Let's see what we can do with it. So yeah, I'm doing Hastings, at least one book. We've been approached to maybe do another one. So we'll see what comes of that. Right now we're still in the source soup, as it were, gathering stuff up, gathering up everything we can about it. I visited the site once. I'll be visiting it again this summer to spend some extra time there to try and glean what one can from the geography, you know, that we have today, and doing a lot of archival work and that kind of stuff as well. So yeah, next up is going to be, I mean, next up, when things come out, I, you know, as soon as the book is done, that's in my past. But yeah, what I'm working on right now is mostly Battle Hastings, and excited about that. Cause it's, I mean, Hastings is a big deal. It's a really big deal. And for darn good reason. I don't have a class that I teach in which I don't talk about Hastings. And so it's really quite wild to be writing a book on it. That's fun.
It's exciting. And you and Kelly, you don't do things by halves, right? So why not go for Crazy and Agincourt? Just what? Add Hastings to it.
Yep. It's funny. Kelly, God bless him. I love Kelly. So Kelly, after Crazy, he says, well, you know, there's nowhere to go here but Agincourt and Hastings. And then when we laughed about it, neither of us had much intention of dealing with this. and then I visited Agincourt, and that sort of snowballed. And again, Kelly was kind of like, well, you know, what's above Agincourt? Hastings. Ha 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 ha. And then yeah, we got contacted asking us to do Hastings, and I was like, well, all right, we're gonna do Hastings. See, I don't know after Hastings. I think I have to retire. Because I don't know what's actually what's higher than Hastings. I don't know what's a bigger deal than Hastings. I mean, Gaugamela, like, do I go back and do Alexander the Great stuff? I don't know. That's pretty tough. That's tough to beat. So yeah, that's where it's at now.
Yeah, you just have to find a classical hornet's nest to start stirring up.
So funny story on that. Last summer, I was in Greece because I was working with another colleague of mine, Mike Cole, who's a great guy. And so we were trying to figure out where and how a couple battles happened there, and we did. And that stuff got published in the Ancient Warfare magazine, published our new understanding of the Battle of Kinescephalae. And we've also done Pydna, though that has not come out yet, but that's very interesting. And so, yeah, while we were there, the Battle of Pharsalia, we were right next to it. And so yeah, we were like, hey, you know, maybe we should do like a Pharsalia case book. And yeah, that'd be cool. We should get somebody to do that. Yeah. So, I mean, thinking about it. We'll see.
And you wonder why you have a reputation.
Why? Again, I don't, not to say that it was in the wrong place, just to say, hey, let's understand it. Let's get all the material. And this is the thing I love about the case books that I do. And I want more people to do these. If you're interested in doing one, send me an email. The idea really is, you know, we're going to put all the sources in one place. And yeah, there's essays, right, in which, you know, for Crazy, I argued, yeah, it's in a different location or whatever. But even if you're like, you know, Livingston is such a moron. He's such an idiot to think that it's not where we always said, where there's no evidence, but that's not a big deal. Even if you want to attack me with ad hominem reviews that you somehow publish, like, whatever. Okay, fine. That doesn't matter for the importance of the casebook. Because the casebook, those sources, they're there in both original language and the translation, right? So even if you're like, oh, well, we hate his translation because he actually, you know, used the dictionary and not Wim. Okay, fine. You still got the original sources. And you have all of them gathered in one spot. I mean, just that fact alone is worth the price of admission. You know, use this, make your own argument to destroy everything I've ever said. Great, fine. But look, I gave you all the evidence. Here it is. You know, have fun with it. Do with it what you will. It's kind of like, you know, showing your work in school as a kid. And you did it in your head, but you're not allowed to. You got to show your work. You know? Okay, well, here's all the work. And so, yeah, if it comes out, you know, X or Y or Z, whatever. We got the work there. And yeah, the Hastings book we're doing right now is not a case book. But, you know, ultimately, I think that would be a fruitful direction.
Well, I'm really looking forward to that whenever it comes out.
There you go.
Thanks, Michael, for talking to us about Agincourt today. And I really hope people will go and read the article in Medieval Warfare and they can decide for themselves.
Absolutely.
Perfect. You can find Michael's article on the battlefield of Agincourt in Volume 9, Issue 1 of Medieval Warfare magazine, which will be appearing on your local newsstands any day now. It's also available for order online at medieval-warfare.com. You can find out what Michael's up to by following him on Twitter at MedievalGuy or visit his website, michaellivingston.com. Before we go, we have Peter from medievalists.net telling us what's on the website. So what's new, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Yeah, we have a bunch of posts that have came out in the last week that I was really proud to kind of post up. We have a special piece from Maria Laura de Brito, who was writing about medieval fairs in Argentina. It was a really fascinating to see the community recreating and exploring the Middle Ages in South America. So I really loved that piece. And then we had a very much different piece type of article from Adam Alley writing about the Zanj Revolt, which is an uprising of African slaves in 9th century Iraq. It's a very in-depth piece. So if you're looking for something, a bit of a longer read, you can find that on the website. And yeah, we had a bunch of really great posts and I was really proud to see all our writers doing stuff. So thanks.
Great. Thanks, Peter. Have you got an idea for an episode or a guest? Send me an email at danielle@medievalists.net. That's Danielle at medievalists.net. Or you can drop me a line on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. You can follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. And you can always find my books, The 5-Minute Medievalist and The 5-Minute Medievalist's Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse on Amazon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Gee Frog. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.